uyakwazi ukuthumela ama-email na.
We translate for those who can't understand. We write for those who can't hear. We describe for those who can't see. SubT, subtitles and accessibility for film, television and theater. SubT.com. Fred.
Hello and welcome to Fred Film Radio. I'm Amani Mohammed.
Fred Film Radio, sono Paolo De Marchi.
簡単にそのセンスの作品のあの紹介を。
Fred Film Radio, Sundana Knight.
Clémence Ferry Latour for Fred Film Radio, en direct du Festival de Cannes.
Fred, the festival experience in 23 languages.
Cinephile, you're listening to the Big Fred Tuesday, Fred Film Radio's weekly show on all things cinema with a particular focus on independent filmmaking and the international film festival scene. The show is hosted and produced by me, yours truly, Matt McCucci, and each week I bring you conversations with filmmakers and preeminent figures of the film world. This week will be no different. But let me start off by mentioning in passing something that by now, by the time you'll hear this show, will feel like old news. The Academy Awards took place at the 25th of April, and so I have to at least acknowledge it. The big winner was Nomadland, as expected, winning Best Film, Best Actress for Frances McDormand, and other Oscars, including a history-making one for Best Director Chloe Zhao, which makes her the first woman of colour to win Best Director in the history of the Academy Awards. Also worth mentioning that Thomas Vinterberg's Another Round won Best Foreign Film, and that Anthony Hopkins took home the Best Actor Oscar for his performance in The Father, which I believe at 83 years old makes him the oldest Oscar winner of this category. So this was just to mention some of the big award winners. Congratulations to all of them. To find interviews with many of this year's Oscar winners and nominees, check out fred.fm, Fred Film Radio. Moving on, we have an exciting show lined up for you this week. The Barcelona Film Festival recently took place, and we'll be speaking about it with Festival Board member David Mitjans. We'll also be speaking with Tuija Halttunen, director of How to Kill a Cloud, as well as Sadri Çetinkaya and Venla Varha, who will be speaking with us about Lost Boys. Both of these films I mentioned are screening at CPH Docs in Copenhagen. We'll also have new entries for our Dictionary of Film and Popcorn Classic recurring segments and more. So fire up an audio teeny, sit back, relax, and listen to the audio waves as they fly through the air.
Fred.
This year's Barcelona Film Festival recently took place, and here to tell us all about it is David Mitjans, who is a member of its board. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Matt. Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure. So right off the bat, this is the first time we get to speak with a representative of the Barcelona Film Festival. Would you be able to maybe introduce it for us so that we have a better sense of what it looks like? Maybe tell us a bit about its history and its mission statement, so to speak.
Yeah, totally. This we finished the festival last week on April 23rd. This was the fifth edition of the festival. We began in 2017, so we are a young festival, but a festival that it's growing step by step. And it's a festival that it's always around St. George Day. The name of the festival is Barcelona Film Fest St. George, St. Jordi. And in Catalonia, well, everywhere in the world, St. George is the International Day of the Book. So then the festival, the official selection of the festival is focused on literary adaptations and biopics and movies based on history, no, history events. So we always are really close to the books. So then, for this reason, we are there in St. George in St. George Day.
So I mean, that is the festival's characteristic and distinctive trait as far as its mission statement is concerned. The films that are presented are somehow related to books in one way or another, or the literary world.
Yeah, because, well, in Barcelona there are many small festivals, so then there was this gap about literature, and we thought that it could be interesting. Think that when we talk about literature can go from manga, Japanese manga, from comics, so many books, many movies are based in literature or are based in a theater play, so then it's easy to find a really interesting lineup.
Aside from that, what do you think makes Barcelona a great city for a festival like this one?
Well, we think that the position of the festival in April, it's really interesting because, as happens in many territories, the autumn, after summer, there are plenty of festivals. For example, in Spain, we have San Sebastian Film Festival in September, Sitges Film Festival, the Genre Festival in October, Valladolid, Sevilla. So many festivals in autumn, after Cannes and Venice, but really few festivals in spring. So then in Spain, we have Malaga Film Festival focused in Spanish movies. But then we believe that there is this important gap and we can fill with our festival. And then Barcelona is a fantastic city in spring. It's really lighty and we have the feeling that it's easy to organize the festival. Of course, with the pandemic, everything becomes more complicated. And then we have the feeling that when you want to invite international talent, invite international talent to Barcelona, it's an interesting option to spend 2 or 3 days for the big names.
You mentioned the pandemic. Now it's only inevitable that we should get into how the festival has responded to these difficult times. Of course, we are recording this interview a few days after the conclusion of the festival. And so how did it take place, so that the listeners know? Did it take place online, in person, a bit of both?
No, no. The festival was 100 face-to-face or physical or presential. I don't know how to say, but it was 100%. Think that it's a festival that it's organized by a cinema. So the idea of the cinema is that people need to go to the cinemas, to the theaters, to see the movies. In the fourth edition last year, it was scheduled for April, and then we were forced, due to the pandemic, to delay the festival. And the festival was also physical, presential, in June. Of course, in the last June, we only had national talent from Catalonia or from Spain. It was impossible to bring people outside Spain due to the restrictions. But this year, again, the festival was presential. And then in this case, we were able to bring international talent. We were fighting with some important things. For example, in Catalonia, there is a curfew at 10 p.m. So it means that we had to finish all the screening at 10. So it means that our last screening time was around 8 or 8:15. So it was a problem, because, of course, we had to reduce the number of screenings, and we lost one of the important screenings, that is the evening screening, no? And then also in Catalonia, all the restaurants and bars close at 5 p.m. So it means that when people was going to the cinema, or when people was leaving the cinema, they were not able to go to drink or to have dinner, no? So, well, there were some things important for the working of the festival. And then, of course, for the presence of talent, we were able to bring Johnny Depp and Isabelle Huppert, for example. But all of them were forced to realize to do a PCR test before coming to Spain, and then, of course, PCR test in Barcelona before leaving and going home.
Right. And in terms of the screenings themselves, were there any security measures?
The good point about this is that the cinemas in Barcelona have been open from November. So then from November until now, the restrictions in the cinemas has been, of course, bring mask during the screenings, keeping the distance, and the capacity of the cinemas are at 50%. So another problem of this festival has been that we only were able to put 50% of the capacity, no? So then let's less money from tickets, no? But well, with the distance, with cleaning the screening rooms before and after the screenings, and with 50% of capacity, we were able to go ahead. These are the normal measures that have been in the commercial screenings since November in Barcelona.
Considering all of these difficulties, then, are you happy with the way things went, especially in the way in which audiences have responded to the festival? Was the attendance good?
Yeah. The attendance, we increased 40% the admissions. So we're more than 11,000 admissions, thinking that the curfew on the 50% of capacity was clearly damaging this, but really happy. And I believe it was 97 out of 121 screenings were sold out.
Wow.
So we are pretty sure that without the 50% restrictions in occupancy, yeah, we would have a lot of more people in the screening rooms. But of course, these restrictions were there.
We'll be back for more on this year's Barcelona Film Festival, and we'll be getting into this year's program as well in a moment.
Fred.
We're back with David Mitjans, member of the board of the Barcelona Film Festival, and we've been speaking about the success, despite the challenges, of this year's edition of the festival. The numbers are great, which also, I guess, speaks to the fact that the audience in Barcelona generally responds well to film events like this.
It's true that sometimes it seems that people prefer to go to a festival than sometimes going to a commercial movie screening, no? Because it seems that when you go to a festival, you're going to something special. It's also true that in our festival, we always try to do a Q&A after the movie. So then if we have talent, if we have Isabel Huppert, or we have a Spanish talent, when we bring people to the festival, then not only do a presentation, because a presentation it's okay, but you know, a presentation it's 5 minutes and then the audience has not seen the movie before, so then it's difficult to be really interesting. But after screening the movie, we have done Q&As. Also this year we did a virtual Q&A with Nicholas Winding Refn, the Danish director, because we presented Valhalla Rising, and Nicholas Winding Refn was confirmed to come to Barcelona, but in Denmark the restrictions to travel are really strong, and when you come back to Denmark you need to do a 10 or 12 days quarantine, and then at the end Nicholas Winding Refn was not able to come, but we did a virtual Q&A, and then when you have a screening and then you have a Q&A, always it's interesting, so more interest to go to the screening.
Great. So I'd love to get into the program of the festival a bit more. But before we do, I noticed one thing, that the poster figure, so to speak, for the festival this year was Jackie Coogan from The Kid, directed by one of my heroes, Charlie Chaplin. So, I mean, I just have to ask you, was there a particular reason for that?
Yeah, well, this year it's the 100th anniversary of the release of The Kid. In 1921. So then the section that every year we dedicate to classics, this year was dedicated to Chaplin. We screened 10 Chaplin movies and 7 shorts. So then we thought that the face of The Kid, the Chaplin's The Kid, will be fantastic. And then for people who doesn't know the poster, we took one still of the kid, and then we put this kid in a cinema, no? So we have the face of the kid, this face with open eyes, seeing a screening in a cinema, and we wanted to transmit that cinema is necessary, and putting this classic face in a modern cinema.
Awesome. I love that. I absolutely love that. That concept, and also to see that Charlie Chaplin's legacy lives on also through the programming of some of the festivals around the world, including the Barcelona Film Festival. But it's time to get into more contemporary times, let's say. As I mentioned earlier, we are recording this interview a few days after the end of the festival. So I think a good place to start might be, would you be able to tell us who or what films were some of the big winners of this year's edition?
The winner film, it was Petit Pays. This is a French film of Eric Barbier about the war in Rwanda. And it's a war seen from the point of view of a kid. No, and then the movie is based on a really bestseller book, Petit Pays, from Gael Faye in France. And then, it was the winner movie of this edition. The actor was Ulrich Thomsen for The Good Traitor, a movie based on Second World War and the Danish ambassador in Washington. And about the actress, it was the actress of Petit Pays, Isabel Cabano, and the actress of The Good Traitor. It was an ex aequo award, and about the Critic Award. It was for Sombra, the world premiere of a Portuguese movie about a mother that is looking for his son that was kidnapped when it was young. And what more? And for the script, the best script was for Yalda, a movie that was presented in Berlin last year, an Iranian movie.
Just to tell our listeners that we actually have an interview with the director and the lead actress, Ana Moreira, of Sombra, if they'd like to know more about it. So
yeah, great.
Just a little self-promotion there other talent available on Fred Film Radio. Are there any other films from the festival that you feel are highlights and that you'd like to mention in our little overview?
Yeah, we were able to open with Promising Your Woman, that a movie with 5 Oscar nominations. So it was an important title, and it's funny because last year in June we closed the festival with Son of Metal, that it has it had 6 Oscar nominations, and we opened this edition with Promising Your Woman. No, so we did a link having US movies with nominations. No, so then this is important, and then of course I believe that this edition was clearly marked for 2 stars. Johnny Depp that present in the festival Minamata, in Spanish is El Fotógrafo de Minamata, and then the movie was in official selection, and then Isabel Huppert presented also in official selection La Daron, comedy and a noir comedy also based on a book. So having Isabel Huppert and Johnny Depp, of course, it was important.
That sounds great. Just to kind of, as a final question, given all of the difficulties that you guys have had to overcome for the past while, especially because of the pandemic and some of the things that you've had to adapt to in recent times, what's your hopes for the future, for a future edition of the festival? Do you see things improving by the time that the next edition of the festival will arrive?
We hope, because after the last difficult for the pandemic reasons editions, we hope that next year there will not be curfews for sure. Restaurants and shops around the cinemas will be open. I have more doubts about the masks. So I don't know what will happen, but I have the strange feeling that maybe the cinemas, the occupancy of the cinemas will not be 50, maybe will be 80, or maybe will be 100%. But I have the feeling that maybe our society will be forced to bring masks in public places, no? So I have, but this is a feeling, I don't know, no? So nobody told this, but I have the feeling that in the future, when we take the underground or when we take the bus, maybe we will be forced to bring masks. And maybe when we go to the cinemas, or maybe when we go to a concert, we also will be forced. I don't know, but then I have the sensation, the feeling that there are audiences, there are people that they don't want to bring the mask to see a movie. So then this will be keep something like a wall for some audiences. No, they will prefer maybe to be at home, comfortable in the sofa, seeing movies in platforms, because at home you don't need to bring the mask. So I don't know this point, but if we don't have curfews and at least we can have 70 or 100% of occupancy, it will be a big jam, no? And of course, for talent, if people can travel from the US, from Denmark, from the UK without PCR tests and without quarantines, it will also be a big help.
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult to tell what will happen even in the near future. So a year from now, it's almost impossible. But one thing is for sure, I definitely wish you all the best with all that's going on. And, fingers crossed for next year's edition of the Barcelona Film Festival. David, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Matt. And I hope that in 12 months, we talk again.
Fingers crossed. In person.
In person.
Fred Film Radio. So Chloe Zhao made history, as we said, becoming the first ever woman of color to win an Academy Award for Best Director for Nomadland a few days ago. But we already knew her before then. In fact, I interviewed her in Cannes in 2015, where she presented her film Songs My Brothers Taught Me in the director's Fortnight section. And here's a clip of that interview.
What is the story of your film?
It is about a Lakota teenager, Johnny, who lives on the Pine Ridge Reservation, and he is planning to leave the reservation to move to Los Angeles with his girlfriend. But his cowboy father, who he's estranged from, suddenly died. He has to decide if he's going to... He's having trouble to leave behind his younger sister, Jishan, who means a lot to him. So he has to make that decision whether he's going to leave home or not.
Now, the film takes place in a very specific region, and it talks about... It's a very specific world with its problems and Pine Ridge. How did you become familiar with the setting and what was going on there?
Mm-hmm. In college, I didn't study film. I studied politics, American politics. So I'm fully aware of Pine Ridge politically and historically, but I never been there. I have a fascination and a love for the Old West, the heartland of America, that I find just fascinating because how young it is in a way, institutionally. Yeah, how old and complex it is. So I started to research the possibility to make a film there. And of course, I started seeing things about Pine Ridge and looking at some photos of people I've taken of young people there. And even within these two-dimensional images, they're so loaded. It's so much complexity. It's not, it's not the simple black and white stories I hear, the struggle or the spirituality. It's not just these things. It's a lot more, especially with the young people in terms of identity. So that's why I took a trip.
I think marginalization is very important in the film. These people, it seems like they can't do anything. They're not given the right opportunities, and they don't seem to have the opportunities that people from more privileged areas have.
I think that is probably the most talked about aspect of Pine Ridge, and I see two different things. One is what you said, historically, and also it's not just the fact of the lack of infrastructure, the lack of opportunities. You probably know this, but to strip away their culture and their language, Lakota culture is passed down through verbally, so not written. So when they're taken to the boarding schools and forbidden to speak the language, when the language is lost, the culture is lost to a great extent. Right, and John Jishan's generation was the first time that the society, the country, actually say, okay, you should be proud to be Native Americans. And so there is that issue, both in terms of opportunity and institution, and also culturally. And there's but at the same time, I live in New York, and I'm always live in big cities. I have opportunity. I went to good schools, but I find a struggle that I have to deal with in society in New York that they actually have much better. That connection with people around you, with your community. If a car breaks down on Pine Ridge, you can be guaranteed the next car passed by will stop. In New York, it doesn't work like that. In China, it's these days it's worse. Right, I felt like if the grocery store is closed on Thanksgiving and I forgot to drive 2 hours to get groceries, you can bet that I can knock on someone's door and I can literally walk in and have dinner with them.
So in a way, you actually have a love for the environment in Pine Ridge. Actually, it shows in the film. There's a lot of sensibility in the way you portray all these vast lands, this very particular landscape, too. So you wanted to get that across, too. It's not like you're trying to say, oh, this place is just forgotten and it's a terrible place. You actually, you have a bit of a romantic look on the area.
I love the heartland of America changed who I am. I was a very... sort of slightly simple-minded, very liberal New Yorker, and almost walking towards the hipster line, a filmmaker. And leaving New York is always hard. People get stuck in New York. And going, driving to South Dakota and starting to spend so much time there, you know, just it's total opposite values. And both politically, culturally, the pacing of life, what's important, priorities, you know. I just become a different person,
yeah,
and a better person, I believe, because I start to understand the gray area of what our society is. It's not just black and white. And I think I have so much love for it that I never wanted to make a film by saying that they shouldn't stay on Pine Ridge. That's why the boy chooses to stay for, not as a fairy tale. So, oh, it's okay, it's great, yeah, everything's fine. No, it's definitely not fine. But he chose to take a chance.
A bit noisy, but there you have it. If you'd like to listen to the full interview, check out fred.fm/UK. That's fred.fm/UK.
Fred Film Radio.
Joining us at this time on the Big Fred Tuesday are Sadri Chetinkaya and Venla Varha, respectively co-director and co-screenwriter, co-editor of a very powerful hybrid documentary called Lost Boys. Not for the squeamish, but that I would definitely recommend. Guys, welcome to the show.
Hi, Matt.
Hi.
It's a pleasure to speak with you. We've got Sadri and Venla on the line. And before we talk about this film, before we begin to talk about it in detail, I wanted to find out more about you guys, because it's the first time we speak. So how long have you known each other, and where did your creative collaboration begin?
Well, creative collaboration. First we met, actually, because we were studying in the same school in Tampere in Finland, media studies, editing, and we were living in a commune together. I had been working on the Lost Boys prequel, Ranger Spotting, for 5 years already, and for the final year of this long project, we decided with Jonas to get Venla on board as a fresh set of eyes, so to speak, and it worked out perfectly. So she continued immediately for the Lost Boys project.
Right. So, I mean, just to fill in the blanks there for the listeners who are not completely familiar with the film yet, let me get this straight. This is a film that's sort of a sequel to Reindeer Spotting, Escape from Santa Land from years ago?
It's a standalone sequel. You don't have to see the first one.
Right. But they are connected in some way.
Yes, they are. The main protagonists both appeared in the first one, meaning, of course, Jonas and Jani.
Right. And so, I mean, you know, just again, to not make sure that the listeners know what we're talking about, and they may not be familiar with the film, would you be able to just kind of say a few words about the story so that, and then we'll get into it in more detail, of course.
Lost Boys was a film that was an immediate continuation of a long project about drug addicts of northern Finland. The main protagonist was found dead in Cambodia after going with the director and a friend of his to celebrate the release of the first film. The first film is called Reindeer Spotting, and completing it took in total 7 years. The sequel, Lost Boys, took 10 years to finalize.
That's a big commitment.
I would say
it's used to it.
Yeah, we are used to it, and I would say it was worth the 10 years, and it was supposed to take as long as it did to turn out how
right.
It was.
I mean, you know, just from your brief introduction there, it does sound like this film is a blend of reality and documentary, right? I mean, after all, and I gotta be honest, it blows my mind that this film is being presented at CPH Docs, because I had not seen Reindeer Spotting, but I gotta tell you that this film felt more like a modern film noir than a documentary to me. But that's kind of what I wanted to ask you is, do you see this film as blending that line between reality and fiction?
Very heavily. Lost Boys is in a very strict definition, it's a construct of a narrative. Technically speaking, the trip that Jonas is going through in this documentary, let's say it has been condensed into one package that can be followed as a film noir. Yeah, type of a neo-noir narrative and a detective story. But the pieces of the puzzle it's been constructed out of is real. And the footage itself is real, even though it has been very creatively edited to seem make a quite short time span of continuous story.
Yeah, one sequence or one scene leading to another, that there's this continuation, like, plot. We like did it, so it would seem like these things, like, come after another. But I think it's, documentaries are like that, some less and some more, that they are constructs. Nothing is like just the reality.
Definitely, and you have to take in mind that we are both editors. So we have an editor's view toward the material, and we know how much it can be rearranged and changed all around.
But were you guys there when the actual footage was being shot, or was it a case that you received the footage and then you constructed it like some sort of a sculpture?
Both. When it came to radio spotting, it had been mostly shot already, but with Lost Boys, we started out with these holiday shots Jonas had filmed with the guys there. And when he went back there to find out what was happened, we basically had a kind of a idea for him to try to capture what he can on camera in case we can, because it kind of screamed also as a that story. There was a story behind all this, but in the end, there was only, in addition to the holiday footage, there was only 4 actual scenes that were taken from this Jonas's first trips, and the rest of the movie has been shot in several shooting trips. Last one of them was in 2015. So footage from several years has been used to construct this narrative.
So several repeat trips to Thailand and Cambodia too?
Yes.
Just to make this clear, the footage that was shot, all of it is essentially real. What we see is essentially real. Nothing was constructed.
Nothing was constructed,
So when we see these men inject needles into their arms, they're actually injecting drugs into their arm.
Yes.
Well, it's a documentary.
Okay, no, but you know, sometimes because it's it's strange enough, but you'd rarely see that.
Maybe we can be considered as connoisseurs.
I mean, I don't know if you've ever done that yourself. I've never done that myself, but I've also never really seen it. I think there's this myth that cinema has the ability to show everything, but I don't think that it's particularly true until you encounter a film like yours that doesn't sugarcoat a theme as delicate as that of drugs, which I don't know how you feel, but it's still taboo, even in the modern world.
Well, we are dancing around a lot of taboos in this film. Well, with the protagonists and many of the other characters being drug users. I wouldn't say this is a film about drugs, but I have to say that the footage surrounding this is phenomenal. Jonas has a very special talent in capturing the moments, especially in this kind of intimate moments. Considering, as I remind, it's not a construct. He has to compose in real. There hasn't been, because the footage wasn't really much shot in 4K or anything, so we couldn't really realign the footage that much. Most of it can be really seen as a live composition on the fly.
We'll be right back in a moment.
Fred.
We're back with Sadri and Venla to talk about Lost Boys. And we had just started to talk about how the film was shot. And so what was the equipment that you filmed with?
What wasn't it filmed with? Basically what we did was always get the best consumer equipment we could afford. Production companies do not provide cameras for this kind of endeavors. So the only footage that was shot with a professional ARRI camera was the footage in the holding cells in between the voiceovers. But consumer stuff, the original party footage was shot in some Olympus tourist camera, motion JPEG stuff. And then, Canon still cameras. It was also important to use equipment that didn't look professional, because basically we were just going there, going around in places like K11, or we're already wearing around the next years or few years of wages for most of these people. So definitely a professional looking film shoot would have just attracted not only too much unwanted attention for the value of the robberies, but also we didn't want to attract attention from the governments.
You didn't have a permit.
Well, we were there on holidays.
There's so much that I'd like to ask you, but I'm going to ask you a simple question now. So the previous film was set in Northern Finland, and this film is set in a completely different setting, Thailand and Cambodia. How do you bring that into the narrative?
Isn't like we really prepared for that, you know. We didn't
have
any kind of plan that there would be a film in Thailand and Cambodia. They were basically, the party material was just stuff Jonas shot for the fun of it there.
Yeah, we did read books about Cambodia. Mm-hmm. And
yeah, over the years,
maybe. We
researched a lot. Yeah, but bringing reindeer spotting into it, we did have some kind of a parallel tropes, you would say, in the narrative. Taking example of the Khmer Rouge sequence with the Le Marseille playing on the background, it was kind of mirroring the moment Yanis climbing the Eiffel Tower with the Ode to Joy playing in Paris.
Yeah, so there is an awareness and a reflection of where and how this place came to be so closely associated, from even a Western perspective, let's face it, with sex tourism and drug tourism.
Well,
we thought about it a lot.
I mean, of course.
I mean, let's face it, you know, it's just something that even when I, for years when I was in college, people were talking about going to Cambodia or Thailand, not to see the sights, but to have a good time.
Yeah.
Well, we didn't really have to establish that much, because it's such a cultural trope that we could basically just do this Pattaya montage and got enough told with that, I think.
Do you, so, I mean, you know, this is a question that sort of, it may seem a bit silly, but, and I don't think that this is the type of film that actually concerns itself with this much, but I'd just like to know how you would respond. Were you guys ever worried of going too far?
Personally, I think we would have known when we have gone too far. I don't think we approached too far with this film.
Yeah, there was, we built up that femme fatale and, you know, that sex thing, but we had in the end, the girls get to have their say, and that was a big part of the balance.
Yeah, and the narrative progresses from this consciously sexist approach, and when Jonas, so to speak, descends deeper into the netherworld, and finally the roles are reversed during the progress of this journey.
Right. Yeah, I mean, also that's the other thing, the other side of kind of feeling like you're going too far is when Jonas is filming all of these dangerous alleyways. I wondered whether, you know, you guys also felt like, you know, are we going too far? Is somebody going to stab us or something like that?
Well, yeah, I mean, going around those alleyways with him was at times a bit unnerving, but I mean, not as far as unnerving if, you know, doing it alone would have been, because it's so much harder to hang two guys discreetly in an alley. Just once.
And did you have ways to like psych yourself up to kind of go ahead and go through with it?
Well, of course you were trying to be sharp and aware and look around you, but the most dangerous moments we had was actually with the Thailand police. So, you know, in the end, around those alleyways, I guess there must have been a luck or some kind of guardian spirit, maybe.
What was the trouble you had with the Thai police?
Let's just say they did street busts, and we didn't have a good sense to bribe the first layer of police. But then again, we had again some kind of a lucky break, and we just got out going without unnecessary testing.
Cool. Let's talk about the style. I mean, it's a very strong style, but do you have any visual or stylistic references in mind when you come up with that sort of filmmaking style? Very sharp, very raw.
I don't know if we can take credits of inventing that much. I guess we have our own style that comes together with our working group. Of course, there is a lot of inspiration from Gaspar Noé.
Apocalypse Now.
Yeah, well, definitely. It's hard to say. I mean, for me, this kind of inspiration, I have seen stuff I like. It lives in my subconscious. I do stuff, and sometimes it's conscious, sometimes it's unconscious. References are everything I've seen so far and liked, I guess. I don't know. I always felt this is kind of a weird way to approach. It's always been a weird question. But yeah, stylistic references were definitely Apocalypse Now, Gaspar Noé stuff, some David Lynch in there, you know.
Yeah, David Lynch is always in there, right?
Yeah, well, yeah. I don't know. Maybe at least in Weirdos.
It's true, it's true. You know, I had actually watched Inland Empire the week before I watched your film, and I just saw a lot of, like, cross-references, not intentional, it's just that...
Inland Empire, I've seen that once.
We watched it together, Sartre. We watched it together.
Really?
If you remember. Yeah. At the commune.
Okay, so I've seen it twice because I've already also seen it in a theater.
Yeah, so that's uh-huh. That's a film that's scary, but I think that even at the scariest parts, you're aware of the fact that those images are constructed. In your film, they're not constructed. Great film. I mean, I love David Lynch.
Well,
that film is underrated when it comes to David Lynch. I mean, nobody talks about it. People say it's a 3-hour long film. But and doesn't make any sense to me. It makes sense. It's very easy to read.
David Lynch films are too short. I mean, we love Bellatar.
Right. Bellatar.
7 hours.
Right. Well, we're going to take a break from talking about Bellatar and Lost Boys, and we'll be back for more in a moment.
Fred Film Radio.
Fred Film Radio.
We're back with Sadri and Venla to talk about Lost Boys, presented at CBH Docs. I have found it to be an original film. But what do you think about that? You mentioned that you didn't want to brag, but you felt that you might have invented a filmmaking style. And that would be a legitimate thing to think about. But how do you feel about people referring to anything you work on as original?
Well, I'm okay with it. I think it's original. I mean, I'm not saying it's not original. I mean, at least I haven't done one like this before. But what I would saying about the constructing the material, obviously the visual style didn't come just by, you know, grabbing a camera and going over there and filming what comes. We did a lot of planned locations, and we did have themes like insects and stuff, which we were deliberately seeking out from the milieu. So we did have a strong plan after the initial trips by Jonas on which direction we were bringing the forthcoming material.
And yeah, I mean, you know, you didn't just go out, but you did have that impulse. And now I'm wondering where that impulse comes from.
Maybe it's because we are Finnish and we have to be, like, humble.
I honestly have to say I wouldn't know what to answer to that question. I mean, for me, it's kind of an underlying process when the film progresses. I mean, I like to script the film on the editing board. Uh-huh. The material comes, we work on it, we see which scenes come alive. And from them we build, I would say, some kind of a golem, a magical construct that comes to life through us. So some kind of a gut feeling when you get something that works and you manage to put it so that it works. You kind of just, you know it. And if there's something that doesn't work, you feel it in your gut and you, even though if you don't consciously know what's wrong with it, repeat this for 10 years and yes, this is what you end up, lost voice.
You know, I mean, you know, exactly. Going back to the fact that 10 years seems like a lot of time. Cinema allows you to kind of take that time, right? I mean, as an art form. What is your impression on the impact that social media is having on cinema and filmmaking?
I'm not on social media.
You know, I almost would have guessed it. From just hearing you speak, I really swear to God, I almost would have guessed it. No. Because it's just the way that you think about images and reflect on things. I don't know. I just got that impression. And that's why I was interested to bring social media into this conversation. Why are you not on social media?
It doesn't seem interesting enough for me to go on there. I don't know.
So, I mean, something like TikTok, which is the opposite of your film, but at the same time, it's also a construct of this use of video where images blend into one. It constructs a version of the world that may or may not exist, that blends reality and fiction, but at the same time, it's completely opposite to your vision of what cinema should be or how the world should be represented.
I think there's an element of that the social media, YouTube, that everybody can be like the documentarist of their own lives. Then there's like doing an hour long thing and putting it in YouTube. So that doesn't like, those are still like very different things, and still there are like documenters needed who do that work, that the long narrative or the hour long thing. But I think it's good that people can express themselves and show their reality to the others from social media or YouTube. But it's not really something that just having this small kind of stylistic things, I think, that, you know, come from there. Somebody talked about how YouTubists have this scene where they open a package and was talking like, in our film, there is this opening of package that these junkies open these drug packages, and that is the same thing, and there's the same feeling. So there's small
the
things.
Unboxing videos.
Yeah, unboxing, yes.
I don't know if YouTube will ever, ever, ever come to show, look, let's see what we have in this box. Oh, it's heroin.
Actually, I think Ranger Spotting actually is on YouTube. So there is an unboxing of heroin scene in that.
Are you kidding me? Reindeer Spotting is on YouTube.
I think somebody has posted it. Yeah,
but YouTube takes down those kind of things like immediately.
I'm also surprised.
Okay, so maybe it's not there anymore.
I don't think so,
guys. This has been this. I feel this conversation has reflected the style of the movie a little bit, and hopefully the listeners were kind of able to keep up with us, and hopefully they were able to be intrigued by it. I gotta say that I loved the film, and I definitely applaud it publicly here. So, and we also have exceeded the time by a lot, and I thank you very much for sticking with me. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks.
Thank you. Fred.
Cinephile, welcome to the Dictionary of Film segment on the Big Fred Tuesday. This is a segment of the show where I focus on one film term that has something to do with film culture, filmmaking, and the cinematic art form, and expand on it a bit. These may be terms that you are familiar with or may already know, but it's always a bit of fun to go back and revisit some of this stuff, even if you are an expert in film. Today, the term I will talk about has a lot to do with film history, and more specifically, the history of film censorship. As we have reached the letter H, what I've chosen to talk about is the Hays Code, which has always fascinated me since I was younger. But for those unfamiliar, this was a series of rigid censorship restrictions imposed on American cinema by the Motion Picture Production Code, beginning in mid-1934, named after Will H. Hays, who was the president of the Motion Picture Producers and Distributors of America from 1922 to 1945. But from 1934 to 1954, the code was just as closely identified with Joseph Breen, the administrator appointed by Hays to enforce the code in Hollywood. The film industry followed the guidelines set by the code well into the late 1950s. In reality, this code had existed since the late 20s, but hadn't vigorously been enacted for a decade as religious groups in the country became more and more concerned with what they saw as a growing immorality that the movies represented. So as early as 1927, the Motion Picture Producers and Distributors of America codified a list of don'ts and be carefuls, which was the backbone of what the Hays Code marked out for the following decades, and that explicitly prescribed what couldn't be shown in films. So things like nakedness and suggestive dances, methods of crime, alleged sex perversion, illegal drug use, scenes of passion, and things like miscegenation, meaning reproduction of people of different races, which goes to show where culturally America was at the time in terms of its racial conflict and discrimination. So when looking at the history of American film, you'll find that generally the movies that were produced in 1934 and before then were more risque, both in themes and content. So that's why such films as I'm No Angel and Babyface from 1933, or even Tarzan and His Mate from 1934, are referred to as pre-code movies. These are films that included more objectionable material, and also, especially in the case of the Tarzan film I mentioned, scanty clothing and nudity. All this was not allowed after 1934. Filmmakers and film producers were constantly restricted by the censorship. Some found their way around it. For example, people like Alfred Hitchcock would include scenes in the copy screen to censors that he knew he'd be forced to take out at the final print so that they wouldn't object to other parts of the film that would have seemed more objectionable otherwise. Such was the case of Psycho, and it's even shown in the 2012 biopic starring Anthony Hopkins as the Hitch himself. Some films produced outside the mainstream studio system were able to get around the code. And then the code began to weaken in the 40s when the topics of rape and interracial relationships appeared in more films. Additionally, many filmmakers found covert ways to get around the code. This, together with the rise of a new competitive technology in television that allowed people to watch movies and entertainment shows from the comfort of their home, as well as other marginal factors like a growing unrest from the audience that saw cinema as being too detached from the reality of the world they lived in, eventually brought down the Hays Code. The Hays Code remains an important moment in American film history, and one that accounts for such vile and hypocritical representation of society that we often see in many of American mainstream films from the time. And that was this week's entry for our Dictionary of Film. Stick around as we'll be back for more film conversation in a moment.
Fred Film Radio.
Joining us at this time is director Tuija Halttunen. She will be talking with us about her new documentary, How to Kill a Cloud. Tuija, welcome to the Big Fred Tuesday.
Hi, Matt. Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
I'm happy that you're here. We're going to be talking about How to Kill a Cloud, screening at CPH Docs. Would you be able to maybe introduce it for our listeners who are not familiar with it, and then we'll begin to dissect it a little more?
Yeah. It's basically a documentary, feature documentary about a Finnish scientist woman who gets a $1.5 million grant from Arab Emirates to make it rain on their desert. That's the kind of the story we follow, but the film has many layers. It deals with ethics and ambition and have an abstract level. So,
And we'll definitely try to talk as much about all of these aspects throughout this interview because I'm super curious. But the simple follow-up question is, what was the starting point for you as far as this project is concerned, as far as this documentary is concerned?
Yeah. About 10 years ago, I read a book about clouds, and I instantly fell in love with them. And I thought, well, this is something I want to make a film about, the clouds, but I didn't have a kind of right angle to or POV. So it took some years, and then suddenly one day I heard an interview about or news about this woman who had got this grant, and I then figured out, well, this is the film I want to make. And soon we got the access. Very soon it was clear to me that this is more than just a film about clouds. So the ethical aspects kind of rose quite quickly after that.
There is something magical about clouds, isn't there?
Yeah. I absolutely do love them. They are so amazing.
And you seem to be inspired by them also just visually speaking. Some of the shots in this film, I feel I should say, are quite beautiful.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, me and my DOP Ville, we did quite a lot of pre-work when considering how to shoot this film and how to bring out the level of clouds in every image. So we tried to really keep them on even in the inside in a room events or everywhere. So we had them in mind and we really paid attention to that level in the film.
Yeah, quite picturesque. So you said that you have had a long-standing fascination with clouds. Have you also always been interested in science?
Well, yeah, kind of, but not professionally. This is the first documentary that is related to science that I make. And I want to kind of emphasize that this is, for me, this is not a science film. I don't know how to make a science film. This is more a film about human choices for me.
And the bureaucracy behind science to some extent.
Yeah. True. That is very important for me. Like how it affects people, or not so much of the content of the science, but the kind of how it affects and on states and nations and humans and so on. That is what interests me. But yes, I'm interested in science.
And you mentioned the ethical dilemma of scientific research.
Yeah.
What is this dilemma that you talk about in this film?
Maybe it is there are several things that made me also ponder my own profession as a filmmaker. First of all, what kind of rose my ethical antennas was the question, who pays the research and who does it benefit? If research is made and when it's made. Of course, it has a very nice parallel to our work as filmmakers also. And then maybe this is the biggest. Who does it benefit? Who benefits of our inventions in science? Maybe that's the biggest ethical. What worries me, or what kind of, this was a long journey. We made the film for about 5 years, so I had a lot of time to ponder these questions. So in the end, what worries me, or where I ended up, was that I realized that we people tend to use everything we invent. Later or sooner, they end up to be weapons or the means to control other people or other countries. And that is something that when it comes to atmosphere, it really worries me. So I thought, yeah.
So when you started the project, did you have any opinions or ideas about this weather manipulation concept? And did you feel like they evolved as you were working on the film?
In the beginning, I knew very little about it. I have to confess it. I only had read about clouds, and I had fell in love with clouds. I knew nothing about weather modification, but I learned in the way, and I really, really tried to study it a lot, so that I knew what I was telling in the film. The first thing that, if I remember, it was years ago, so it's very hard to remember what I first think, but I think, in the beginning, my main concern was that who is capable of using these methods? Maybe that was the, and then when we filmed more, I realized that atmosphere is such a complex and chaotic system that even the best minds that work in that branch of science don't know yet how it affects when they do something there. So because it's so very chaotic and complex, they actually don't know what they cause when they do something there. So that's maybe that started to me worry a bit as well. Although I have to say, and I have to emphasize also this, that I don't think that these things should not be research, or the science shouldn't be there, because it's in our nature trying to understand the world around us. We all do it in a other way or some other way. So, but yeah. There are things that have to be taken in consideration and not let the ambition or things like that to blind us.
We'll be back with Tuija Halttunen after this short break, so stay tuned.
Fred Film Radio.
We're back on the Big Fred Tuesday with director Tuija Halttunen, whose new film, How to Kill a Cloud, is screening as part of the CPH docs this year. Regarding filming in UAE, Tuija, was it difficult to film there, particularly some of the meetings and events that you filmed?
At first, it was quite taskful. It was very hard to get the access. I was very persistent. It took about a year to, and they didn't even answer my emails at first. But I have to admit that they respect our main character a lot there. She's a very high-leveled scientist, so it helped that she had given her access. So when we got the access, after we got the access, it was quite easy to film in the conferences and meetings and so on. Well, there were points when they said that now you have to leave, but very few. They let us to film quite freely inside the buildings, but filming altogether in UAE is very, there are many restrictions and rules, and it was very, we had a kind of a person to check out.
And did they understand what you were doing? What did you tell them you were filming?
I said we are following the journey of Hannele Korhonen.
Oh, okay. Generally speaking, we talked about your interest and fascination with clouds also is reflected in the style of the film and some of the picturesque shots. What about filming some of the landscapes in the UAE? Did you find it visually stimulating?
Yeah, true, of course. And the contrast between the built cities, the fabulous scientific sci-fi cities with those amazing skyscrapers, and then just a few kilometers outside the cities and you'll find these other kind of landscapes. And I really liked that contrast. It was, of course, very stimulating.
Yeah, because as people are researching about AI and other future technologies, you find yourself sometimes occasionally in the middle of the desert, it looks like a post-apocalyptic landscape. Yeah. It's really cool. You know, it's almost like, wait, careful, because things can go wrong.
Yeah.
if you program something wrong, it could end up being pretty disastrous for the planet. And that was a really cool contrast, aside from the actual contrast of the texture of the sand and the clouds. It's really cool. So I think you talked about it earlier. Was it important for you to document the film from the perspective of a female scientist?
When I started to do the film, it was not my main concern that I should find a female protagonist. But when it happened, I was, of course, happy because I am a female and I think there should be more female protagonists. And she happened to be very clever, very, very intelligent, and of course it was also lucky that she, in that field of science, she is one of the few in the middle of male dominant world, so it was it of course is always more interesting film wise also.
But is there a discussion in the scientific world about the fact that there should be more women?
I don't know actually. I think of course there are many female scientists also in many scientific branches, but I think in physics and probably when it comes to weather research, weather modification science, I think there are very few women.
Okay, Tuija, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Matt. It was very nice that you are interested in our film. It's very dear to us.
Fred.
Thomas Vinterberg won the Academy Award for another round, Best International Feature or Foreign Feature. I'm not sure what they call that category nowadays. But anyways, let's revisit Chiara Nicoletti's interview with a Danish director and his two actors from the film, Mads Mikkelsen and Magnus Milang from last year's Rome Film Fest. Take a listen.
Is there such a thing as the midlife crisis, a moment in our life in which we need to like shake things up a little bit?
Well, I think hopefully the movie is about more than just a midlife crisis. I think we can all, in all ages above 20, feel that life becomes repetitive, monotonous, and too safe. I have a very young wife, and if I look into her friends and their sex lives and their marriages, they experience crisis as well. They experience boredom and lack of curiosity as well. So narrowing it down to a midlife crisis would be too small, I think.
What do you think? Well, it definitely exists. And as Thomas just said, it can happen at any time. I mean, maybe not when you're very young, because that's a highway of life ahead of you. You don't care. 30 is just a number. 40 is just a number. 50 is a bigger number. And it's kind of halfway through. you start looking at, okay, what's left? What did I do right? What did I do wrong? But to turn it into a crisis is not a necessity. You can also look at it and say, okay, let's move on.
Manolo?
Yes. Well, my character is about 40. And his crisis is more that it's repetitive with the small kids. And you find yourself being an extra in your own life. And that can also be sort of a crisis where you need to fill yourself up with lots of alcohol.
I was reading the director's note that, and you wrote, this is an homage to the alcohol's ability to set us free. And I was thinking that, do you think that at some point we should all find our way to, let's say, deal with losing control a little bit and get it back? I mean, that's...
Right. The film is about more than alcohol. It's exactly about losing control. It's about the uncontrollable, as it's being called. It's about allowing yourself that risk in life of letting life decide. Instead of trying to control everything, plan everything, measure everything, let it happen to you. I guess that's what they do, these four men. They impose risk in their life and they reawaken from it.
What I liked about Thomas' films is that he never judges the characters, and this helps us, the audience, to feel empathetic and really relate to the characters, to get in their shoes, mm-hmm. in a way. So I was wondering, what's your approach? Do you feel that when you're shooting?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. He doesn't judge his characters. And I should say that should be a rule number one for every director. Yeah. But it's obviously it's lovely that we are there to defend our characters. That's what we do. And then the story will take them a certain way, and people will leave the movie theater with an idea of who they were. And of course, in the end of the day, he will manipulate some kind of morality into it. But just, you know, deciding from the beginning we like or we don't like a character, that is a no-go.
Yeah, otherwise we wouldn't like the film if we don't like the characters, yeah. ourselves.
Moral obligations is not necessarily very creative. We're just exploring, and we're doing it as best as we can. But we are trying desperately to avoid moral obligations, political dilemmas, gender debates. This is a study of human beings.
I totally agree. You know, I was reading some film reviews of your films, and I have to say that one was saying that there is a more realistic, slow and subtle way of the characters getting into the alcohol loop you know, and getting into the alcohol loop, you know, the, and this felt a bit like Le Grand Bœuf, you know. So I was wondering, what are your what's your references in this term, and if you think that there's a it was also compared to American films, there are more flashy. Some, so do you feel there's a our European way of doing things, maybe a little bit of Italian as well?
Well, we were definitely inspired by Le Grand Bœuf.
Le Grand Bœuf.
And Matt claims that there's something Italian about this movie, and I think, and I hope he's right, some of my heroes, greatest heroes, are Italian. Pasolini, Fellini. I think 8.5 is a complete masterpiece. You know, these movies are possibly somewhere in my system and to be recognized on the screen. I don't know. We also looked at Husbands by Cassavetes.
Mm-hmm.
And Fight Club, actually. But not for so long.
So, Matt, agree? Do you agree?
Yes.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I wasn't part of that process, obviously, but the reason why I said that, that it was his most Italian film is that, well, Thomas's films are always about life to a certain degree, and this is even more so about embracing life and the present. But there's something, it doesn't matter how dark, how brutal an Italian film gets, you kind of leave the movie theater with a feeling of life. There's always life in there that makes you somehow not cry, but to a certain degree smile when you leave the theater. And that's what I think he did.
And I promise you, we don't say the same thing in Sweden,
yeah,
or in France or Norway.
No, this is his most Swedish film.
This is not a traveling gimmick.
Wallace, think once I heard that the best movies are the ones with the musical number for apparently no reason at all. So I was wondering, is that why, I don't want to spoil too much, but there are some very good dance moves?
Well, that sounds slightly speculative. The, you know, the ending of this movie, we don't want to spoil too much, is a liberation of a character and an attempt to create ecstasy, because that's what you can do with alcohol. You can create weightlessness and ecstasy and even group ecstasy. And that's an amazing thing when it happens. And hopefully with the help of Mads Mikkelsen, we succeed by in doing that at the end of our movie.
The famous dance moves that famous you already had.
Yeah. Well, I can't really add to that. It's yeah, we didn't approach it as that. We approached it as a... the mood, what was going on inside of this character at this point. I mean, he just lost something, he just gained something. At the same time, he wants to fly, he also wants to drown. And that's what we are trying to achieve.
Is that, we, in this sense, there's a, in, let's say, an open ending, can we say that? Like, life is dead, like that.
Well, I think that he's flying in a positive way.
But, yeah.
But it might be open, not to me.
Well, you know, it is open. He can fly, he can fall, but I agree with Manolo next to me. I want him to fly, and that's why I think he's flying. But I'm not the one who's deciding. If there's like 360 people or 200, as in Italy, 200 people in the cinema, there should be 200 different films being watched and 200 different solutions.
Totally agree with that, and that's what I love about cinema. So let's leave it like that. Thank you so much, Thomas Pinter.
Thank you,
Matt Mikkelsen, Manolo Milang,
Maunus,
for being with us and talking about another round screening at the 15th edition of Rome Film Festival in the official selection. And this is Chiara Nicoletti for Fred, the Festival Insider.
To listen to the full interview, check out fred.fm/UK. That's fred.fm/UK.
Fred.
Cinephile, we have reached the end of the show. But before we say goodbye, as usual, I will end it with a recommendation for alternate cinema viewing. Hopefully, my weekly recommendations are helping you discover a whole new cinema out there that often entails venturing outside the bounds of popular SVOD platforms like Netflix and Disney Plus and so on. You know the ones. This week's popcorn classic may surprise those who think of me as a highbrow snob, which nothing could be further from the truth. I like to drink my wine from cardboard, so there you have it. But specifically, I am talking about the 11th film of the fabled Godzilla series. It is from 1971, and it was directed by Yoshimitsu Banu. It's called Godzilla vs. Hedorah. And this one was maybe the film with the lowest budget in the super popular Japanese creature feature series, or kaiju as they are known there, up to that point. But in my opinion, it's more than made up for it in creativity. Also worth mentioning is that this movie is marked by environmentalist themes, which still feel fresh and new to this day. The monster in question has been birthed from crazy pollution caused by humans on Earth, and when Hedorah begins to terrorize people, it is up to Godzilla to save the day. That's right, because it may surprise some unfamiliar with the Godzilla movies, but the series, which has been around since 1954, saw Godzilla play both antagonistic roles and the hero throughout its several films, the latest edition of which, of course, was Godzilla vs. King Kong, or Kong, I can't remember which one exactly, released earlier this year. Anyways, like I said, Godzilla vs. Hedorah is a classic, and it may seem cheesy to some, but to me, there is nothing wrong with that. I even find its vintage men in costumes type of special effects great. There's also a real creative drive behind it that often entails a creative use of animation mixed into a live-action contest. Not to mention that, again, the environmentalist themes make it seem all the more modern to this day, as Godzilla vs. Hedorah celebrates its 50th birthday this year. That's my recommendation for this week, Godzilla vs. Hedorah from 1971. Give it a look and see what you think. I will give it 5 bags of popcorn, 5 cups of soda, and a little Godzilla plush toy, because even scary looking giant monsters can be absolutely adorable. And that's all for me, folks. Join me next week once again as we continue to venture through movie land on a future episode of the Big Fred Tuesday. I hope you enjoyed this one, and I urge you to check out more content that is featured across all channels of Fred Film Radio. So till the next time, stay healthy, stay safe, stay strong, stay cinephile, and stay tuned to Fred Film Radio, the festival insider.
Fred.
Benvenuti su Fred Film Radio, the Festival Insider.
This is Fred Film Radio, I'm Eddie Bertotti.
Clémence Ferry-Latour for Fred Film Radio, en direct du Festival de Cannes.
Tantanni sono senza un soccino, hanno scioccato.
Alan Beconfi, Fred Film Radio, Marco Mamoragan.
Fred, the festival experience in 23 languages.
Fred Film Radio.
24/7 on Fred.fm and smartphone apps.